welcome to the Climate Tech Talks. I'm your host, David Contreras, an energy professional with over 12 years of experience in the sector. We will explore in this series, along with CEOs, founders, and the leaders in the clean and climate tech sector, the different pathways and technologies that will drive society towards a net zero future. Please join us. The views expressed in this podcast are my own and do not reflect the opinion of my current employer, TES. In this episode, you will hear from Jack McFarlane, the CEO of DeepString Technologies. We had a very product-led discussion on how to disrupt a monolithic process or the procurement RFX experience with an elegant and beautiful SaaS solution. I learned a lot with Jack. At the end of this episode, you will hear how he's actually helping the clean sector to further decarbonize. Enjoy! Welcome to the Climate Tech Talks, Jack. How are you?
Hey, I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. And I heard that you're joining us somewhere in Mexico. Is that where you are?
That is right. So I escaped for New Year's to Mexico to work in the sun, and I haven't been back since. So that's all very good on that front, I'd say.
Well, lucky you. We're very jealous.
I keep seeing the pictures in the news of England hitting, you know, -5 and snowstorms in New York, and it couldn't feel like more of a world away than it does.
Yeah, amazing. No, thank you, Jack. I thought a good idea to start this is for you to describe DeepString, who you are, what sort of company, and what sort of clients you're serving, and from there I will just backtrack a bit about your background and how you actually got to be the CEO of the company. So if you want to describe DeepString for everyone in the audience.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess the easiest way to describe what DeepString does, it's a technology company. And the problem which we identified was the number and the volume of emails and attachments that were being exchanged during the kind of what we call the RFX process or the tendering process. So every time businesses were going out to go for quotes, be it a simple quote or a very, very complex quote, project-based tendering, all of these kind of business-to-business communication efforts were done on emails and attachments. So, you know, in its simplest terms, what DeepString does is it just takes all of that communication and it puts it on a very slick, user-friendly digital application. So instead of having to exchange, you know, hundreds, if not thousands or tens of thousands of emails and attachments with suppliers and third parties, under the scope of getting transactions done, now you can do it in a very, very easy, user-friendly, and highly automated way through a digital application, kind of saving our clients time, reducing compliance risks, and just generally increasing the efficiency of that kind of RFX communication process.
Brilliant. That's a great pitch. So before we dig deep into DeepString and what you guys, you know, do and how you're doing it, obviously you're a software company. Let's just start from the beginning. So from the research and background that I did and looking at your, you know, profile, etc., I realized that you were born in Africa and then raised in deep, darkest Peru, I saw online. So can you summarize those two? How that happened?
Trying to be Paddington Bear. Well, I mean, it was really like, you know, these events were outside of my control. So I didn't have a say in where I was born, but my parents did. But I was born in Egypt, and then I actually traveled. Well, I grew up not just in Peru. I grew up in Peru. I grew up in India. I grew up in France, and I grew up in Tanzania in Africa before coming to England when I was about 14. So that was a bit of a journey. That's kind of like my early life story was going to lots and lots of different schools in lots of random countries around the world.
And then you came back to the UK? Is that how it worked?
Yeah, exactly. So my family is from Oxford. So when I was around 13, 14, I came back to the UK and went to school there.
And you did some, well, you went to London School of Economics. You did some economics there. Do you think that your early experiences around the world informed that decision? It's like, hey, I'm just going to study economics for, you know, what was the thinking behind it?
I mean, slightly maybe. I'd say like as with most human beings, it's potentially a path of least resistance coupled with potential returns in making that kind of decision around what to study at university. I was always lucky to be okay at kind of maths and quantitative stuff, but I also enjoyed like the arts, English, and kind of those kind of studies. And the economics to me just felt like a natural hybrid of those two things. It had some kind of arts aspect to it, but it was also extremely kind of mathy and quantitative. And again, from a purely selfish perspective, that meant that I had to study less for exams because you generally don't have to learn as much when you're doing quantitative stuff. You can work it out from first principles. So that suited me quite well. And I guess, you know, maybe there's an underlying thing in the back of my head around, you know, I've always been interested in kind of global trade and like how businesses interact with each other. And I'm very kind of, I very much like the kind of, you know, business and capitalist world that we have, and maybe that did have some influence on wanting to do economics, either kind of as an end in itself, but also as a means to, you know, going into the business world later on.
Oh, fascinating. I'm just going to suggest maybe you can turn off your video, but I'm going to ask you, so you had quite a successful stint then in a couple of banks. You were in at UBS. So from that, I guess one key question for me really is how you made that transition. Then it's like, hey, you have a successful career in banking and investing. How did that jump into, you know, I'm going to lead the RFX portal and you know, be the CEO of a software company, basically?
Yeah, it's a very good question, David. I guess a lot of it's just around like wanting a new challenge and wanting to do something fresh and new. I thought investment banking was really, really fun. I had a really, really good time. A lot of hard work, but it was really, really cool. Had a very, very supportive team and network around me. So it wasn't a kind of like desperation to get out so much. It was more maybe being cognizant of the fact that, you know, after, you know, 8 or so years in a role that was becoming even more niche, right? I just felt like I needed a fresh challenge, something new. I potentially thought I had something to prove in terms of like wanting to set up a company. I also really like having kind of teams around me that kind of like are loyal and you can work together towards like shared ambitions, which is, I guess, a bit more, a bit stronger within your own company than it is within a kind of large corporate. So it was a lot of that, just wanting a new challenge.
Yeah.
I think I was about 28 at the time. So I'd been in banking for seven, 8 years. And I kind of like, you know, I was mapping out my next 5 to 10 years and did I want to be, senior guy in investment banking with, you know, heavier and heavier golden cufflink, or not gold, golden high handcuffs. And the answer is no. So I kind of took the decision to bounce out of that. I was actually working in New York at the time, and just took the decision to leave. And I'd actually invested as like one of the very, very early investors in DeepStream when they were just an idea.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And as part of that, I kind of got to know the company a bit and got to know the team as it was at the time. And that kind of led me to, in discussions with them, basically deciding that, it would be a good thing for both sides if I kind of came on board
to take the role of the company. Yeah.
It was like that was kind of a slightly serendipitous route.
Yeah.
As with everything in life, massively driven by luck and chance. And yeah, it kind of like, that's how the cookie crumbled for me. Anyway.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that it's one of those key elements in many people's lives, and luck that, you know, people tend to underestimate. So I'm curious then. So you made the jump, you decided, you talked to the founder team. Were you part of the Techstars story? Were you leading that? And how did that work? How was that connection? What did Techstars give to DeepStream? And yeah, what did you learn from them to, you know, continue the business moving forward?
Yeah, so that's Techstars is a phenomenal kind of outfit. I was part of that journey. So I was involved in the Techstars energy program that was based in Oslo. That was done kind of in partnership with Equinor and Kongsberg and McKinsey, the consultants. So yeah, that was a really interesting process. I mean, it was the application process seemed fairly straightforward in terms of just applying and then going to Oslo to pitch our vision and what we had in mind. In terms of the main benefit we took from it, and I know other companies take different benefits, often depending on what kind of stage they're at, but a lot of the benefit we took from it was around validation in the industry. So, you know, obviously we were a smaller startup at that point in time. We didn't have like established relationships with industry contacts. We didn't have, you know, the ability to pick up the phone and get into the right people, and also, given that we're so early stage, you know, it's quite hard to validate ourselves in an incredibly risk-averse industry. So I think just having the Techstars brand behind you, the McKinsey brand behind you, and leveraging their network was probably the thing that we benefited the most out of that.
Yeah, I guess it's that the power of those partnerships, right? Did they help you define the market? I mean, how did you decide to focus on, for example, oil and gas? That's my understanding. How did that happen? Was that organic? Was that the result of many iterations? Like, hey, what's the industry that is more ripe for this kind of innovation and in the, you know, RFX? And if you can describe RFX, probably maybe some of our audience don't know that industry.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I guess, to answer your second point first, the RFX is, you know, X is the variable, right? So X is anything. So it's not really an industry in itself. It's a request for quotation or request for proposal or request for information or request for basically requesting data, right? So it's what we're trying to encapsulate when we say the RFX process is the entirety of the data exchange and communication between people at different businesses. When they're tendering.
But procurement.
Yeah, so procurement. So anything that's a tender-based transaction. So anything that you have to request information from a counterparty to help you arrive at the decision of whether you're going to trade with that counterparty or not. So it can be anything from like multi-stage requests where you go out for like an RFI at the beginning and it turns into like an RFP and then you do like an auction stage at the end. Or it could be something as simple as like, oh, I need to fix a chart, like a vessel for 30 days, this route, I'm going out to 25 suppliers, give me your best quotes. Like, so it's just requesting data, and that entire process is done on emails and attachments right now, which has a lot of kind of both inefficiencies and risks attached to it. So that, again, RFX is just requesting for, you know, anything in terms of communication.
And if may add, those are processes that can be quite cumbersome, bureaucratic, slow, the kind of things that are ripe for disruption, right?
Yeah, unbelievable. Like, I mean, I don't have a background in this, right? So I've never, thankfully, you know, been in the trenches with regards to running a kind of tendering operation in a large corporate. But, you know, from what I've learned and from what I see, and from what we talk to our clients about, is yeah, that process is unbelievably rigid. It's unbelievably inefficient. It's unbelievably kind of document driven.
I've seen it myself. It's
just
tough,
incredible,
painful,
right? And our entire approach is not to not to take the process and try and make it more efficient. Our approach is actually to redefine the process to some extent, to be like, guys and girls, what are you doing? Right? You're just asking for information and prices and terms and information from your counterparties in arriving to awarding a transaction.
So why then the energy industry then?
So actually, and this is your first, I guess, question just before asking our effects, is we're not at all focused solely on oil and gas, right? So it's a slight misconception of our business. When we did start off, so back in late 2016, early 2017, the initial idea of the company was to be a kind of a marketplace for oil and gas goods and service providers. So that was the kind of initial business vision. But that kind of quickly changed. And when I came on board, it definitely changed. In terms of being a much more kind of industry agnostic platform, to the extent that we cater for use cases that have the same, you know, characteristics. So for example, you know, we have the largest kind of, gigafactory, battery producer is one of our clients, the largest in Europe. We've got, you know, like brokers like Braemar, who are our clients, in the shipping space. We've got, oil and gas companies like Premier Oil, who are our clients. So we actually cater for like a pretty wide variety of industries. I would say they all fit into the kind of heavy industrial, space where there's, you know, a high degree of compliance required, for procurement or tendering. And there's a high amount of kind of data that's exchanged between businesses and getting that award decision under that RFX process, as we call it.
So what's the beauty of the solution that you bring? Obviously, you bring transparency. I was just reading, so auditability. But how would you define then the benefits? And obviously, how large then is this market? What are your ambitions? Or what else? Or which... You just said it's technology and industry agnostic, but how do you see it? What's the roadmap for you?
So I guess to answer your question on what the beauty of the solution is, and I like the question. I guess the way which we look at it and the benefits come out of this, right? So when we look at other software that's tried to attack this problem, they've all started off in the kind of accounting, you know, back office, ERP, place. And they've almost extended into this RFX process. So they've tried to kind of cater for it via modules that they add on that they call, you know, strategic sourcing modules or whatever. Our main issue with those companies and our clients' main issue with those companies is that they try and run a very prescriptive software approach. So they will look at how you procure and they will try and automate that within that same pathway. So if you do exactly the same thing and you do not deviate, it works incredibly well. But when you look at like pretty much all of the transactions that occur in the, you know, tendering or RFX space, they all are a bit different, right? They're all got some quirks to them, right? They're never kind of cookie cutter versions of previous processes. So what that means from a software perspective is that those companies that have those software providers that have a very prescriptive approach actually force users to go off the software and use emails, because emails are the ultimate flexible tool, right? You can basically write anything you want in there and you can attach anything you want, right? So that's why all of the communication happens on emails and attachments, right? Regardless of what these legacy systems they've got in place. So that was a key challenge for us. And in trying to create like a beautiful software solution for our users, we took that problem to heart, right? So one of the fundamental pillars of the DeepStream software solution is it's unbelievably flexible. Right. So we call it a kind of blank canvas approach. I mean, our main competitor is emails and attachments. So we're trying to eradicate them, and we can only eradicate them by, you know, fighting fire with fire and providing a solution that's not just as user-friendly, but as flexible as possible. So you can create whatever workflow you want with your suppliers. You can make it complicated, or you can make it super simple. You can make it like a one-liner, or you can make it a 10-stage request. So yeah, we empower our users to basically run flexible processes, which means that they won't feel the urge or the need to deviate to emails and attachments. So in terms of, like, that's a big kind of USP, as far as I'm concerned, of our product, our software. And in terms of the benefits it provides, I mean, you know, one of the key requirements for clients, especially in today's world, is around running sustainable processes that have full transparency. Now, if you're running, you know, over 50% of all your communication is done by emails and attachments, it is impossible to oversee that communication flow. And it's pretty much impossible to audit that communication. I mean, technically you can audit emails, but you know, it costs you tens of millions of dollars. You always do it after the event when something really bad has happened. And, it's just a complete nightmare. So, that kind of compliance and auditability perspective, when you put all of that communication on a platform like ours, you have real-time visibility from your team of everything they're doing. You have real-time audit logs of every single action that any user has taken with regards to communicating with other people in that RFX process. So you have like a complete, you know, overview from a compliance perspective that everything you're doing, and even if you're using intermediaries or joint venture partners or other kind of businesses, you can basically have assurance that you're running a totally transparent and compliant process without impinging on any confidentiality restrictions that you might have and kind of sensitivity. So that's a big, big benefit which our users see from our platform. The other one is, I guess, just efficiency gains. You know, like when you're running, yeah, I mean, we have some clients that will run tenders at like a 5 stages, and they probably have 600 documents, right? And they're going out to 30 suppliers, right? Just think of that from an efficiency perspective. If you're doing it on emails and attachments, like, it's a nightmare. You literally have to employ like a couple of people just to be dealing with that kind of admin. Now, bringing some automation into the picture, like, reduces the friction of having to run that process. So you can get trades done quicker. Your suppliers can be engaged with you more often. You know, you can go out to more suppliers. You can just run a much, much more efficient process. So that gives you a lot of kind of like whatever operational cost savings, as well as kind of compliance enhancement.
So yeah, it does offer that flexibility, less friction, as you mentioned. No, it does sound like a very, very attractive you know, USP, as you said. So let me go back. Let's just talk a bit quickly on the past, on what happened last year. And maybe we can wrap up with the future. But let's start with 2020. 2020, we are all aware, it was quite tough for everyone, from a professional perspective, for many companies that went under and, you know, saw their revenues evaporate, to obviously to the human level and the huge loss. Everyone, you know, working from home, etc. So many challenges. But having said that, I understand that you guys, DeepStream, had a really good year. Why was that? And how do you deconstruct that, those results, if you can describe them?
Yeah, it's again a really interesting one, and we're very fortunate, obviously, to have had the results which we did in 2020. So 2020, from a obviously purely business perspective, was fantastic for DeepStream and the company. Like, we saw the number of clients we have on the platform probably go up by 15 times, the number of, like, the amount of dollar flow go through the platform probably increased about 20 times. Like, it was a serious the positive growth year for us.
But you think that was because of the COVID acceleration and what was happening, or?
So, I mean, I think it was a mix, right? So, and I've thought about this question quite a bit and trying to come up with an honest answer to myself, because it's very relevant in the times that we're in. So I think it's a mixture. I think that, you know, one part of business is the sales cycle isn't that short, right? So it takes quite a while, although we've shortened it takes a decent amount of time to close clients, basically, to get them paying for our software and using it. So I think that a lot of the efforts that we've put in the second half of 2019 and the first half of 2020, you know, started to just crystallize, you know, in Q2, Q3 of last year. So I think, you know, a lot of it was just down to like that grind work which we had put in the previous 6 months was starting to pay off. There was a big and significant difference given the remote working environment. So I try and dissect that, and it's very much like one is, you know, digitalization just from a thematic point of view, which helps in getting meetings, to be honest, and getting in a room with clients, went up the agenda, right? So everyone was talking about digitalization. You had the situation where, you know, within a matter of weeks, you know, entire companies had been moved remote, right? So like, even if you were quite old school and you didn't really like computers and whatever, you were basically forced to be in front of a computer and on Zoom calls all day, right? So the kind of receptivity to technology and digitization, and the understanding from a lot of our target market that digitization was there as like a tool to facilitate their business, and it was relevant and they needed to increase their use of digital tools, like, definitely was apparent, right, in terms of getting meetings and closing meetings. So it just made it a lot kind of easier to get in the room. And once we're in the room with clients in the Zoom room, not the real room,
yeah,
it was easier to close and get them to start using and engaging with the software. So definitely that was a, you know, silver lining for us from a business perspective of the pandemic. And I guess also played to our strengths slightly. I mean, we're like a very young, very tech first company. And so we don't employ, you know, like an army of salespeople who will go and wine and dine clients and, you know, meet them in their offices to close deals, which is a kind of traditional approach. We will basically rely on technology, phone calls, Zoom calls to do all of our kind of interactions with clients. And that put us at a relative advantage versus competitors, because we were already doing that, right? That was already our modus operandi. So
it's all about obviously having a product led strategy, right? I mean, it's the strength of the software and the product that you're offering, in fact.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we tell our clients, right? We have three-month walk-away rights for nearly all of our contracts with our clients. Basically, we tell our clients, look, if you don't want the software, you don't need to commit for long term, right? We only want you as clients if you're actually getting value from the software, which is a very, very product-led approach. And although it sounds a bit obvious, you know, when you look at how software companies have, you know, the big software companies have taken advantage of corporates in the past, you know, they ask them to sign up to 2, 3, 4, 5 year contracts before they've even started to use the software, right?
Yeah.
And so we very much tried to flip that on its head and take a product first approach in engaging with our clients.
It makes sense. And it's very refreshing, you know, having that strategy right there and representing what you are. So let's just try to wrap up. So what does 2021 look like for DeepStream? And what sort of goalposts? What are the goalposts? I mean, you grew last year, you signed new logos, but what sort of things or landmarks are you looking for in terms of more growth? Are you perhaps considering raising more capital? Are you growing your team? I understand you have now 8 people. So what are those key things that you want or you would like, you know, the company to pursue in the next, let's say, 2 to 3 years?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'd say, you know, where our current heads are at is we've been trying to make the best decisions given what we've seen in the past 9 months. So I think of us sitting across the phone or with you in this time last year, right? We would probably have been raising money in 2020. That was kind of what we were expecting to do. But given the kind of growth which we saw from clients and users and revenues at the company level, like, we didn't need to raise money in 2020, which was fantastic. And we've got a lot more buffer in 2021 as well. And we're actually nearing profitability, which is kind of very good for if you look at how tech companies normally operate in the first, like, 5-10 years
of their life.
We will be raising some cash in the first half of this year. I think that, yeah, we've been keeping the team extremely lean, right? So we have this kind of ethos of just trying to hire as good as people as we can, and not hire for hiring's sake, which means we have a very small and dedicated and strong team. But I think that we will probably be investing heavily in the, you know, again, true to our core in the kind of product and development side of our software. You know, our software is what sells. We get most of our sales through, like, referrals from existing clients. So instead of, like, employing huge sales resources, we actually take the maybe slightly longer term view that we want to be deploying capital into our software, which is our main asset,
your product,
and having that drive the business. So yeah, so we'll be raising cash. We will be continuing to grow our client list, and we have some very ambitious and strong targets around client growth for this year. And we will be investing heavily in product, software development, as well, obviously, as other parts of the business.
Any particular industry that you are trying to tap into that you have actually entered in 2020?
So I think the one of the really cool industries which we're in is the kind of the gigafactory space, so renewable batteries, which is growing like crazy.
It's going to be gigantic.
It's really, really, really interesting for us because it's a type of company that, you know, they're growing really fast. They have a lot of capital, and they, even though they're huge companies, these gigafactory battery producers, they think of themselves as startups, right? So they think of themselves as, you know, having this agile mindset. They're not bogged down with, like, legacy systems aren't fit for purpose. So they're really, you know, from a corporate perspective, they are going from, like, 0 to 100 pretty quickly, and they're allowed to make their decisions without being encumbered by prior decisions that have been made. So that has been really attractive for us because, you know, they like DeepStream. They like the similar kind of mindset that we have to them, our product-first approach. So that's a really, really interesting space which we're already in, and we're looking to grow in 2021. Another one which is a bit like that is around autos, so automobile industry. It's one that keeps coming up again and again and again around how much in need they are of a solution like ours, given the kind of RFX dynamics which they have.
That includes the electric mobility kind of space, I would imagine.
Yeah, exactly. And that also couples quite well with the other kind of client base which we have, which is around the, you know, the renewable battery producers that produce a lot of the batteries for these electric automobiles. So that's a very interesting space for us for 2021.
Yeah, so that leads me to the last question then. So would you say that DeepStream is taking an active role into, you know, decarbonization, the whole energy transition discussion, and it's part of the theme of this podcast, but do you think that you guys are playing an active role in that space?
I think that we're contributing to that, right?
Yep.
I don't think we're like a massive driving force, right? So I think if you look at I mean, just giving you an example, one of our clients, before they used DeepStream, they had to run this kind of like sealed bid tendering process, which is ridiculously, they had to all get into a room in like the Netherlands somewhere and like all sit together and open the bids together.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy when you think about it. And so now they use DeepStream. This is all done electronically with an electronic audit trail. They can unlock their bids like on the platform. But, you know, moving from that process to a digital one means that the guys don't have to fly.
Yeah.
They don't have to exchange papers. They don't have to, like, you know, wreck the planet with all of this kind of stuff. And we kind of help contribute in some way to digitizing that entire process, which does reduce kind of emissions, etc. Again, I'm not saying it's a massive, massive driving force that's going to change the world in that respect, but it definitely is a contributor.
No, it helps.
The second area where we're trying to take a more active role, I think, is around just increasing the transparency of suppliers in the market, right? So you're seeing a lot of initiatives right now around supplier ratings from a kind of carbon perspective and like a sustainability perspective.
Yeah.
And so you've got a lot of these kind of like accreditation companies. And a lot of the actual suppliers are being pushed to publish more stuff around, you know, what their emissions are and like how they're contributing to the reduction of the carbon footprint of their kind of supply chain. And, you know, I would just say that the more, in a general sense, the more the market becomes transparent and the more, you know, digital tools like ours facilitate suppliers to demonstrate their credentials in this space, rather than it being very hidden and very opaque and, you know, oh, you might hear it from someone, but we're not really sure. So the more that becomes a more kind of transparent marketplace where you can see more supply information driving you to want to trade with that supplier based off your desired kind of carbon principles, the faster we're going to get there, right? So the faster you're going to see buyers switching to suppliers that, you know, have better kind of environmental credentials. You're going to see more buyers being like, actually, let's start integrating, you know, in our evaluation process. So we have like an evaluation model on the product, including the evaluation process. Yeah, we're really interested in, you know, the CO2 emissions that go into manufacturing this thing that we're buying from you. And that's going to be part of our evaluation. So the more we can, through digitization of information, the more we can make that more transparent, the faster we're going to facilitate the market to find a new equilibrium where they're going to be able to take into account these factors as well as all the factors they've been taking into account previously.
Yeah. Oh, you're correct. I mean, the whole relevance now and everyone highlighting the ESG in terms of investing, in terms of making those decisions to support or not certain companies. I totally agree with you. And it's good. It's good to hear that you guys are sitting to huge mega trends and you're you know, adding so much value to the whole ecosystem. So great to have you here, Jack. It's been a really great conversation and hopefully I have you here again soon.
Absolutely, David. I appreciate your time. Thank you for having me on. And I hope to catch up soon. And I hope this gave a little glimpse of the DeepStream life to some of your listeners.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, man. Bye-bye. If you like this episode, please subscribe and give us a like. It really is important for us. This episode was produced by Julio César Fernández.